Americans are losing faith in higher education. Nearly half of adults believe a college degree is less important to get a well-paying job than it was 20 years ago. And only a quarter believe that your degree is a very important part of getting a job that pays well. That's how former Florida Governor Jeb Bush began a recent op-ed piece. Bush is also the founder and chair of Excellent Ed, an organization that, in its own words, supports state leaders in transforming education to unlock opportunity and lifelong success for each and every child. Polling notwithstanding, American universities are facing new questions about their purpose. How are they adjusting to address those questions, and what will tomorrow's university look like? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Johannes Britz, the Senior Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs at the Universities of Wisconsin, and welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you so much, Norman. Thank you for having me.
Big question to start with here. We could go the whole hour, but yeah. For the time being, what is the purpose of a college education, and do you think that has changed in the last 50, 60, 70 years?
No, yeah, well, that's also a philosophical question, right? And me, myself, being an educator, you know, if I have to reflect on it a little bit philosophical, my own thoughts why I actually became an educator reflects this very question, right? I firmly believe that, you know, and I was influenced by the thoughts of Amartya Sen, and I might say his name incorrectly, but a philosopher, economist, to shape my mind about everybody has been born with certain capabilities, gifts, and talents. And we have to, it's our responsibility as a society to structure our society in such a way that allows every individual to become who they truly want to be, right? And that is human freedom at the individual level. And that drove me to think, if we structure a society to allow individuals to become truly who they want to be, what better opportunity do we have on education? From primary education right through to tertiary education. So it's not just for me, and it is important, workforce and finding a job, but it's also the ability of people for full development. So that is how I really look at education, that it is fundamental to society. Whatever we argue, however we look at higher education, it is fundamental to any society. And I don't know of any American that I've met that would say we don't value education. Having said that, I think, you know, and that is still the purpose. That was 2,000 years ago, the purpose. That is still the purpose. And, you know, higher education started, of course, with medicine, theology, and I think law was the main areas where it really worked out. And then different areas developed over time. But what I think what has changed in the last 50, 40 years, one is the financial model. Since 1980s, specifically in the U.S., I'm not necessarily talking about Europe or other parts of the world, but in the U.S., tuition increased, right? And universities became more dependent on the tuition of students than before. That changed. The financial model did change.
Why did it change?
I think it was my opinion from what I've read and see from the 1980s, right, that there was also a sense do the taxpayers have to pay when there's a benefit for a student when they find a job somewhere. There's also, I think, a political space to say, why do we fund public higher education? So I think that changed in the 1980s. And then, in my opinion, from what I understand, it's not anymore just a partisan political issue, right? It became kind of, that's the norm, right? We increase tuition and lower taxes. So I think the financial model did change. And universities had to adapt to that to say tuition has become a very, very important part of our financial model, as well as a philanthropic support. Chancellor's role has become increasingly over the last 50 years fundraising. And then I think the third thing on the financial model is to be savvy to work with political leaders to understand that you can secure funding from the state to move forward as you move on. So I think the financial model did change, and we had to adapt to that. The other big thing that I think that changed over the last 50 years is technology. We lived till the 1990s in a pretty much what I just called a bundled world, books, right? If you buy your airline ticket, you go to Northwest, whatever, and buy your ticket. Somebody sell you the ticket. It's a hard copy ticket. Your seat gets assigned when you enter. And when the internet came, and with it, the economics of information that unbundled the world, you don't need those offices anymore. You assign your seat. You order your food. You buy your airline ticket. You change your airline tickets. That fundamentally unbundled the banking industry, the music industry, the media, you name it, right? Every single business entity changed due to the unbundling, the economics, the wayless economy. That was a huge paradigm shift in the 1990s, and it moved on. Higher education embraced that. I remember when I came here as a visiting professor at UWM in Milwaukee, we started to teach online. The first Masters of Library and Information Science degree was online. That was revolutionary at the time. So that is one way that it impacted the business model of universities, was the way we start pedagogy changed and teaching changed, right? The online spaces we moved in. And I remember there were professors at the time said, I'm not teaching online. This is nothing for me. I'm not embracing that change. Today, higher education has become also unbundled, right? You get your virtual check, you sign off your leave. Everything has become unbundled. Now what has happened, that I still look at the future, and we can talk later about more about that's intriguing for me, is artificial intelligence, which is a next step. I mean, AI is not new, but generative AI is kind of newer, and it grabbed the attention and the imagination of people. But I think with AI, we didn't just unbundle information. We started to unbundle knowledge. And I am very curious to see where that is going to take us. So technology changed. And it changed rapidly since the 1990s as we move forward. So if we look for the next 25 years, I think that is going to be an even more drastic change for how we do our business at higher education. Then I just think, you know, disciplines emerged. Right? 50 years ago, we didn't really have disciplines like data sciences and big data, right?
Sure.
It all emerged with the internet and predictable analytics. Think of the ethical discourse, right? If you're in philosophy and ethics, wow, that is one of the most exciting disciplines to be in, to really reflect societal from an ethical perspective on what's happening. And new courses got developed, new curriculum got developed, new degree programs developed. I normally use one example how jobs has changed. Librarians. On campuses, right?
Very much so.
I mean, I remember when we talked about there will be a paperless society. Of course, we print now more papers, right, than we ever had. And books will be gone while we still use books. But librarians were challenged in the 1990s. Where are they going with the unbundled world? How was the training going to look like? And they realigned themselves. They changed their curriculum and their training drastically, not just to say we survive, but they thrive in a digital economy, which is information-driven. That's just one example how work at a university and training of like librarians has changed and adapted to the change of the world that we're moving in.
Will those changes, those technological changes, online learning and a lot of paperless and I venture to say bookless teaching, how's that going to affect the cost? Will the cost go down if you don't have to buy a $120 textbook?
Norman, you raise, for me, actually, a deeper issue here, and that's the cost of higher education, just affordability.
Of course.
I mean, in Wisconsin, we are affordable, one of the most affordable public systems in the Midwest. And I'm proud of that, right? But there are students who simply don't have the money, right? Who need money to fix the car, to replace a tire, to buy food. We sometimes don't know about the real needs of students. So affordability is a big issue. Coming back to your question then, how do we support, if you can unbundle the world, of course, you know, the publishers and, you know, the publishing industry also realigned their world.
Very much.
I mean, the long tail economy, right? What you sell, you keep. If you download for $1 or whatever a music, Spotify, whoever keeps it, and they resell it. I mean, that's a whole new economic model that happened. The same with publications, right? You buy access. You don't buy the owner of that copy anymore. So what then happened in the copyright space and the economic space and the affordability space was changing copyright laws in the sense of the Creative Commons.
Oh, yes. The Creative Commons has become a big player, hasn't it?
Exactly. And it's all, for me, the way I look at it from a moral perspective is to make it accessible and affordable for our students. Because how can they afford a textbook that's $120? Where if they can actually buy access or get it in the Creative Commons or get it in a digital repository in a library where their own faculty produce it for free to be accessed by the students. So we actually use the same very technology to make it accessible at no cost, if possible, to our students. I know at UWM, the savings when I was still there, the provost, was $3-4 million for students' dollars that they did not have to pay the books. But we work on what we call the open education resources. That is, for me, critical in terms of affordability. And I think we have a moral imperative to do that for our students so that they don't have to buy the expensive textbooks where there's an alternative, same quality, available for our students, produced with our key good faculty in an open education resource model.
Is the financial incentive still there for the faculty, though? I mean, there have been traditionally considerable profits, both for the publisher and, I would assume, correspondingly for the authors of textbooks. But if you're offering it online for, say, $5 instead of $95, is there still the inspiration, the impetus for the faculty to produce textbooks like that?
You know, I'm not so sure where it is at this point, since because I'm longer out of the faculty line. My answer to that was, you know, if you do make fun and money out of the book that you write and this, go continue with that. There are different models. You can say students buy a chapter that they can use. Affordable, it's not just to have to say it's a hard copy book that you buy. My answer that I, how I would look to that, if I teach a general education requirement course, for example, for students in philosophy and ethics, whatever, it's just my area, I would, from my moral standpoint, say, if I can publish it and make it for free available to students for them to learn, and it helps them to get through at a more affordable price, I will do that. If the university and the library allow me that infrastructure, I will be motivated to do that, just to help.
Is the more technologically advanced university then a price savings for the University of Wisconsin if they don't have to pay for as many offices, they don't have to pay as much wear and tear on facilities if it's a largely a remotely taught campus?
So Norman, that is a question that came up through COVID, right? And when people unbundle their offices and work remotely and then say, are we returning to offices never again? And we sell buildings and some businesses went there and now what I learned and what I read and say, no, you all need to come back. We need still the human interaction. So it was cyclic, right? It was kind of the pendulum and everybody, yep, I work from home or I work remote and I buy another house at another state. I think that paradigm is changing again. I think the human element of being together is always there. I think in higher education, it is not as simplistic. I think they are, depending on the kind of students, if there are students who study full-time online, they work, they cannot go to a campus, they never see the campus. They study fully online at a course at, say, Stout, you know, or at Green Bay, doesn't matter. They live out of state. They don't need that. But then there are full-time students who are 18 years old who do the 4 years of experience on a campus. They might be hybrid. Many of our students are on a campus. And actually, we've seen another increase in our enrollments this year from new freshmen, which is, for me, wonderful, right, that we see more students coming. Some of them take an online course, but they're also on a campus. So it's relative to say you can replace buildings with technology because of the human and the infrastructure that we have. And I'm still of the opinion, and I might be kind of a generation that I say, nah, maybe you missed this out, but I still believe that there are place and space for the digital, and there's place and space for the bundled, where you really can sit down and talk and interact with one another. So I firmly believe in both. I think it's also a fallacy in a way to say technology makes it cheaper or that it's actually for free. It's not. I remember when I was the dean at the School of Information Studies at UWM, you know, we had to build the infrastructure to support the online teaching. And that cost money. That cost people. That cost experts. In those days, we didn't have all the experts and the cameras and the support that we have to provide for the students. And in the labor intensity to teach online, it's not PowerPoints that you put out there. You teach and you're accessible. And your accessibility is not your office hours. It is when you are digitally there. And I always felt if a student texts me or email me or communicate, I have to respond. So it depends how you look at that. But for me, it's not necessary. If you take it very seriously, it's labor intensive because you have to reach out more. And there's an infrastructure that does cost. In the long term, you save a lot of money on a lot of things, but it creates other places where you actually need to reinvest. I remember when we rolled out Wi-Fi. We didn't know where to start, right? 25 to 8. Do we start in the library? What's the budget for Wi-Fi? right? That's cost. And now I think about AI, right? And I think, okay, so what's the budget for AI? Many campuses would say, well, we don't really know that yet, because what do you mean by what you're saying? What is the, I mean, so I think there's always a cost. It brings more efficiencies. It realigns jobs, but it will continue to be a cost.
Well, speaking of costs, then further, if we look at a graph of tuition, I'm going to say broaden it to in the United States, over the course of the last 50 years, we see a dramatic increase, and this is adjusted for inflation. The example that comes to mind is something like from 1969, if it was $5,000, now it would be peaking at the top there somewhere around
$9,000, $10,000.
And then it goes all the way up from there considerably. And again, this is averaged across the country. Do you see that curve tapering off or continuing to rise? And what then are the causes of this rise? And how, for example, do faculty salaries play into it?
Norman, these are heavy questions.
And you're the man to answer them.
Well, I again, coming back to my philosophy, right, what I told you right at the beginning, higher education or education is there to allow people the opportunity to become who they want to be. And predominantly for me, that should be public higher education, right? If people afford it and they can go to privates, fine. But it's our responsibility as a society to allow that to happen for people, right? That's for me a base comment. And that is also, and I say this because that also define for me pricing. You have to be affordable. It doesn't have to be free. A human right is not free necessarily, but it must be affordable. And affordability does not necessarily only mean the tuition that you ask, because sometimes you need to cover your cost. If you want to have the best education, the best faculty, you have to pay them to get them and to keep them. So sometimes, you know, the tuition offset your own cost, right? And as I mentioned, how we are now tuition dependent, that we have never been in the last 50 years or so. For me, that is also where do we come in to support students so that it can be affordable for them. Very interestingly enough, we, you know, again, bipartisan, Democrat or Republican, doesn't matter to me. In 2005, 2004, I think in this state, we raised tuition in two consecutive years, I think by 17%, right? And that was a huge increase.
Yes.
And the, you know, when I was in discussions at that time, I just started here kind of a career, and it's like, well, I was in shock coming from Europe and South Africa that wow, this is expensive. But the notion was, yes, students and parents will pay that. Well, they could. But by 2010, this was the first time, I think 2010, that student debt surpassed credit card debt. And I think that helped to change perception, in not in a good way. The affordability and the cost of higher education is too expensive. And the job I find to pay back for what I've borrowed has become... So I think that increase over a period of time, continuous increase, led to that perception that you just listed right at the very start when you read it and say, the perception of higher education has changed because of that. Now, of course, universities can say, well, you know, we needed that tuition because of state support that declined, enrollments that declined. How on earth do we get... So there's always many arguments that people can use. The interesting thing for me that happened in, I would say, like 3-4 years ago, when I started learning about a tuition promise. And I thought by myself philosophically again when I reflect and said, so it's not anymore just increase of tuition. It has become too expensive for many of our students. The affordability issue is changing to a support issue, right? And so for a state like Minnesota started, and you know, here at the University of Wisconsin, we had is now our second tuition promise program. It's just the last dollar that will help a student who simply cannot afford it. If you have a minimum income as a family of, say, $60,000, I'm just making up the number, and you get your Pell funding or whatever, your last dollar, we will support that. So we invite you, we give you direct admit to our campuses. And by the way, if this is your threshold of income and you cannot afford it, we will help you. And that's a shift. When I thought of 25, that was not in any political space a paradigm. Now we are here. I think it's the necessity of the affordability that makes us more creative in helping students.
When you say we will help you, do you mean in terms of a loan or direct support that doesn't require repayment?
It's direct support. Last dollar. I mean, you look at everything that you do get in your support, right, and your Pell eligibility and the funding that you get from the federal government, other grants that you do get, whatever you own, we support that for you. It's not a loan.
We're going to look further at the phenomenon of the future of higher education, particularly at the Wisconsin level, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. Back with my guest, Johannes Britz. He is the Senior Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs at the Universities of Wisconsin. And we're looking at the future of higher education, a large topic, but we can get some insights into it by looking in particular at the Wisconsin phenomenon. And we get back to the original question, Johannes, with this hour, and that is, what is that college education really for? You seem to be saying that the way the financial model has changed over the years, that there's a greater emphasis on, I'll say, the practicality, the monetary aspect of getting a job when you get out of college. Where do we stand with that at Wisconsin in particular?
Well, yeah, this, again, it's for me kind of a philosophical question to start off with. You know, again, as I said, what I believe in education is to allow people the ability to become who they want to be, right? Hairdresser, engineer, nurse, whatever. But there's more than that. It's the ability to argue, the ability to think more critically, the ability to write well, the ability to be in good discourse with people. It's just well-roundedness, right? But in the end, I mean, you do study to get a career out of it, right? For me, that's why I understand when people say, you know, we pay tuition. The state say there's tax dollars that go into, what is the return on investment, right?
I understand that argument.
And, you know, and I think it's always good to say, you know, if you study a 99% placement of your students and that makes a 100% sense, right? I study for an engineer, I end up to be an engineer. I study for a nurse, that's why I do this. But there's more to it than that. That's the fundamental issue for me. And that's why I actually, coming to the United States, I discovered general education. I said, wow, that is actually fantastic, right? The balance that you have, ethical reasoning, writing. Well, we will see how AI is going to change, right? Are we going to be creative writers or creative editors, right? There's a lot of nuances that intrigues me extremely.
Yes.
But also just to use the basic skills that you need in your life to enable you to be truly good at what you do. And normally when we sit here, when I told you, you know, what I planned in my life didn't happen, right? I end up totally sitting here in Madison, where I come from a total different country, was going to study totally different something. I think when you do graduate and there's creativity with your graduation and passion for the world and for life, you might not end up being an engineer your whole life. That basic that you get in your education the first 2 years or the 3 or the 4 years will open up more opportunities, right? So I think we also need to understand and know that, yes, you study to get a degree, to have a professional career and have a good income, and data supports that. B, there's the philosophical issue that it is a well-rounded individual that can make a meaningful contribution to society that is well-educated. I cannot enough emphasize that. And thirdly, it gives you, I would say ticket is probably the wrong word, but it gives you the opportunity also, more so than for people who don't have that education, to change careers as you move in your life. That you say, you know what? I never thought I will do this. Now I look back, how did I end up here? And when you really look back, you can say the foundation was already laid when I studied at this institution to allow that to happen. So this is how I would look at the return on investment and career readiness. I mean, it is very important, but there's more to it.
There is a tradition in university curricula that for the first 2 years, there are certain required courses. It would be English, maybe biology, a number of required courses for those first 2 years. And then by the time you're a junior and senior, you're maybe concentrating more on what you think would be your career trajectory. And then, of course, there's graduate school. Is that still the general thinking at Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's still kind of the general thinking. You know, we have realigned over time because sometimes you get students coming in, they're freshmen, and they don't know what they want to do. Or they tell you, listen, I want to do something in health or something in IT, but I still don't know. I think that individual attention to that student is key, right? That's why universities invest more resources in support for those students, right? Like student help or an advisor that can work with you. But universities where I come from, you know, at UWM, we change also what we call meta majors. They just say, well, you're not sure where you're going in. You want to do something in health? You do these courses, right? This is the package that we kind of designed for you. We work with you. So when you come in your third year, you know, then you say, you know, nursing was the one I really... So you don't have to do too many credits because that is part of the issue. You want cost reduction, efficiency, and well-planned for a student on a pathway so that they graduate with 120 credits and not 140. Because they picked it incorrectly. So that, I think, is our responsibility also to help the students, even those that are unsure, to guide them, to help them, because it's human, right? And you might, what am I doing? You know, and that, I think, that component of interaction with them to help them. Also, that's why we use technology, predictability, right? And human courses that you pick when you are where in your studies is really becoming a much more sophisticated effort than, I would say, 10 years ago.
What's the relationship between the universities of Wisconsin and the high schools of Wisconsin?
Norman, that's also a very interesting and a very important question. You know, I got intrigued again with when President Roffman told me, you know, look a little bit about the future of higher education. Where are we going, right? And I led a little group and I was intrigued by it. And I can tell you the documentation I read, almost all the documents and experts said the future of higher education go through K-12.
Wouldn't you think?
Yeah. Kind of logic, right?
But often overlooked.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the fact that they said, you know, if you really want to thrive in the future of higher education, you need to be solid with your K-12 line pipeline. And that explains to me why I think we really reevaluate our relationship with dual enrollments. Now, dual enrollments, right, when they take courses at high school and they already have done it and they come to a campus and they've already completed like 15 credits through the two final years of high school, it's not for everybody, but it's a certain opportunity. It saves your cost because it's much more affordable. And when you're done, I think it's also a good branding and marketing opportunity for us, right? To say, wow, you've done this. Look, we are the Universities of Wisconsin. We have the best university system in the world, right? You can just go from your high school to one of our campuses. You already took our courses. So I think it creates that. But also it prepares students much more, right? To be ready when they enter the university level, and they don't have to do all the credits while they are there, right? So, and it can help them also to do more practical work, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So strategically, in our strategic plan, we said we must make sure that we align ourselves even better with the dual enrollment space. And actually, President Roffman charged us about 2 years ago to do a task force with very specific recommendations, right, on dual enrollments. And I think it's critical that we work with, you know, the private colleges as well as the technical colleges and all the high schools to align ourselves even better, because we're not too well aligned at this point in terms of dual enrollment. So I think dual enrollment is absolutely a necessity to invest in our future. So, and the other one, Norman, if I can just say, I think direct admit.
Yes, I was going to ask.
It's going to be a critical component. I thought that was just, you know, UW Green Bay started that as a pilot early on, and then we followed. And I just want to give credit to my team. We are about 70% of public high schools already signed up in 2 years, right? We're now in our third year. That's amazing if you see the lift that we did, right? And we can see increase in enrollments Now, it's very early to say it's exactly because of dual enrollments, but I can tell you, I think it's one of the main variables. We'll wait for the data to prove what my hypothesis is here. But with a direct admit, you know, when 10 of our campuses are currently participating in a direct admit, you get a letter as a high school student and say, you know what, you don't even have to apply. You already admitted to these campuses, and pick your campus and we will follow up with you.
If you're one of the, what, top 5% in your grade?
Yeah, Norman, that's guaranteed admit. There's a difference
that's
between
guaranteed.
Guaranteed admit. Okay. It's in statute. And that came, I think, last year, where it says the top 5% of students are automatically guaranteed admit to Madison, and the top 10% are guaranteed to be admitted to the other campuses.
And this question comes up, though.
Yeah.
How do you weigh 5% top at one high school versus another, or even courses in the same high school? If you're taking a not very demanding course versus something very demanding.
Yeah. Correct. That is a complicated question, but I know at this point it's answered at high school level, right, that we started to do that. So it's important also for listeners to understand the difference between the direct admit, which is 10 of our campuses. You're directly admitted. This is your GPA, your second high, your final, second high, I always get confused on the American grade 11 grades.
The junior year,
yeah,
yes.
Junior year, mm-hmm. Yeah. And you get the letter that you're directly admitted, and you can actually don't even have to apply. You know, they reach out to you, you're admitted.
And how is that different then from
guaranteed admit is the top 5% of high school is admitted. You go through the process, but you are guaranteed to be admitted to Madison of your class. The top 10% of your class is guaranteed to be admitted to the other campuses. And that's in legislature, in statute.
Is it a good thing? Is it a desired thing for the universities of Wisconsin to get bigger and bigger, especially as demographics change over the years?
Well, the challenge was we get smaller and smaller, right, over a period of time. I mean, since 2010, our enrollments declined, right? And that was the challenge. And the other challenge for us was our participation rate declined too, right? Students who choose to actually go to a university or actually pick our universities. And if you just look at the future, if that, you know, if the demographic holds and we see less high school students and we see a decrease in participation, we will have not just a problem with the universities, we will have a problem with the state, just simply because of workforce needs, right? If you want to have a growing economy and if you really want to have workforce kind of where we need to go with engineers, with nursing, healthcare, STEM disciplines, you need to train them. We need a workforce, right? And so I think what we, you know, strategically how we think about this is we really need to make sure that more students end up from Wisconsin high schools with us. We have seen again an increase in participation rate. We've seen more students coming back. I'm very grateful for that. Of course, as an educator, I think give you the opportunity to truly become who you want to be. But B, also for universities, just more enrollments, right? It does help. And C, for the workforce, right? Future engineers coming back. They study through us. So my hope would be that we can increase the participation rate. We do that with dual enrollments. We do this with direct admit, right? We do this with aggressive marketing. We do this with affordability. We do this with the tuition promise. So we have a good strategic plan in place, and we are seeing slightly as we move forward results in not being too big. It is just bring back what we have in this state and keep it to the benefit of the future of this state.
There have been campuses, entire campuses that have been closed down in recent years, I believe.
Branch campuses, yeah, the former two-year colleges. Five of them closed down or changed.
Any more in peril of that?
Norman, that's it. You know, if you asked me 5 years ago, we would be with the campuses that was assigned to the main campuses, I would not have necessarily predicted, you know, that we would end instruction at five of the campuses. I would say, in other words, what I'm saying is I cannot predict again the future. But what in my opinion will determine the future as we look at is financial viability. Right? We are accountable, right, to the taxpayers and to the students. If it's not financially viable, you need to make a plan. Secondly, if enrollments go so down that it is not any more viable just from an instructional perspective, you need to make a plan. And that's what actually happened in most of these cases. And thirdly, I think very close collaboration with the community. And I firmly believe in creativity and innovation. I mean, perseverance, going through things is you need to be creative, right? And I've seen some very creative approaches with our former two-year campuses, you know, the branch, as we call them, the branch. That is really so. I think creativity, accountability, and enrollments will determine on a campus where they go with that space.
How closely does the UW system work with employers? And do you have, I'm going to give an example, I'll just say Microsoft, for example, a relationship in which they say, well, we really need, you know, these experts in AI or whatever it might be. What can you do for us in terms of curriculum? And
And by the way, you know, we prefer to talk about the universities of Wisconsin, not just the system. It's really the universities of Wisconsin, our 13 universities, kind of how we look at that. I mean, for me, Norman, your question is just the imperative is the universities cannot be a university if we do not interact effectively with our industry partners, right? Full stop. I mean, if you look at our Freshwater Collaborate, right, all 13 universities participate. We actually get funding also from the legislature. Bipartisan say, this is good. We have fresh water here. Look at this. They interact. They have people working within industry on future water researches, future technology that deals with clean water, et cetera, et cetera. Then you look like our Polytechnique Stout working, right? Students interact with industry. They cannot be a Polytechnique if they do not interact all the lab work that they do. When you look at UWM, that's where I come from. So that's unfortunately the best example I have. You know, Northwestern Mutual with data scientists at Marquette University, preparing the work. This is our need. Come to us, you know, presence on campuses, right? Johnson's Control, Madison, you know, with all the big industry. It's unthinkable. We will not survive. We will not have a right if we do not interact aggressively in the space of industry.
So working with industry, working with the community, working with the high schools, and we'll find out what else is in the future for the Universities of Wisconsin when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Johannes Spritz. He's the Senior Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs at the Universities of Wisconsin, and we're looking at the future of higher education, and particularly in Wisconsin, as things change considerably. And one of the big factors in change in recent years was COVID. What kind of impact did COVID have financially and academically on the University of Wisconsin?
Yeah, Norman, I was counting the days, like, you know, when it was the 11th of March, 2020, it felt like yesterday when I was the provost on the campus. And that morning, I got all the faculty and instructors together and we decided, okay, we need to start planning. And are we going to flip some courses online, which cannot flip online? And then that afternoon, we heard there was a COVID case still untested. And within 2 hours, we extended the spring break by a week, make it 2 weeks, which was coming up. And then we flipped 6,000 sections in 2 weeks online.
Kudos.
So if you ever think of the magnitude of change when there's a crisis, there's no better example. That's how we started off. And I remember cleaning, you know, and it happened with everybody who was there working, right? You had to clean your office, you had to leave. So it's nothing unique. But for higher education, that was our biggest concern. What about instruction? And then we didn't know, are people coming back? Are students coming back? What about the dorms? Are we closed till April? That year, we had no playbook, right? And do we wear masks? So I think the impact psychologically, but also just from a financial and the business model was shocking. We did not know what to do next. And, you know, I remember when I talked to my colleague, the chief business officer, and we had to start making decisions. And we said, these are decisions about life and death, right? That is how serious it was. From just the human component of the unknown of this virus. But more as we move on, you know, and we settle and we move around, and we thought, are we going to make it financially? Are we just going to teach online? And how long is this going to last? What about all the income from the dorms, you know, auxiliaries, support? We did not know, honestly, if we will survive this. That was the concern. Of course, at that point, you don't communicate this out loud, because you don't want to create more anxiety and more fear. Where are we going?
But didn't know how long it was going to go on.
Exactly. That was the concerns we had, right? And we had to, I mean, it's leadership, right? You have to manage and lead in a time of crisis without creating more anxiety. But the unknown, and just say, people, we simply don't know what is next, right? And if it wasn't for the federal support that we've received and the perseverance of our staff and our faculty to go through this, which I amend and applaud and said, I can just raise my hat and say thank you. And then the financial support that we get carried us through that. And so I think that was the immediate impact, was just the human component, the unknown, the crisis. The fact that universities can change in 2 weeks, right? The crisis is there. And then the financial uncertainty and how do we restructure? And if it wasn't for the federal funding and that support, we simply would not have made it.
Speaking of federal funding, what's the relationship between the universities of Wisconsin and money from the federal government going forward?
Well, as all, you know, research universities, you know, universities of Wisconsin included, we're dependent on that kind of funding, right? NSF, NHI, whatever, we do funding. So I think that, you know, as there was in the past some comments about that as well, it came very fast, right, from January on. And the initial impact was also unknown. Where are we going? I think when we start our own analysis, particularly Madison, UW-Madison, to a lesser extent UW-Milwaukee, and then of course from the other campuses as well. But I think the concerning part for me is just the kind of research that it will impact. Like, you know, when we look at diabetes or cancer research or Alzheimer's research, and you talk to the researchers about that, and we made some public appearances as well, President Rothman, you know, with the Chancellor of Madison, expressing concern. And so to bring also the message, a powerful message of what we believe in, and it's not a political message, it is these research that we are doing does help the society and community from a health perspective. And the hope would be that people would say, well, this does not, we cannot not fund this. So I think it does definitely have an impact on what we do.
Is there likely to be or maybe it's been happening for a long time, if there's a course has trouble attracting students, does it just disappear? I mean, if I want to take, I don't know, Greek or something like that, and there are not that many students for Greek, is it going to go away? Has it traditionally worked that way?
You know, I think sometimes also a perception that universities just offer. It's not the case, right? Specifically in a financial, more constrained space that we are in since 2010, 2008, become more challenging on campuses. So if, you know, there's normally that campuses, specifically a provost, would look at enrollment and say, you know what, we can't offer this course, it's low enrolled. And the threshold can vary, right? Sometimes it's a course that needs to be taken, like American Sign Language, you can say you only have a few. But if it's a different course, like Greek, and say there's not enough enrollments, we simply don't offer it. So for this semester, it's not offered. That's one approach to say courses are not offered because of enrollments. That is always a case at universities. You don't teach a summer course because it doesn't have enough enrolled, right? That's also an equation, because that's a financial model and a teaching model that works out.
You offer the course, but then if you find out it doesn't have enough customers, you drop it?
Well, then it gets removed, yeah. Specifically with the summer. So, you know, sorry, not enough enrollment, you're not going to offer it. And then, you know, students enroll earlier, so you can see in the spring or the fall semester and say, you know, we're not offering it. But it's also degree programs, not just specific courses, that's the issue. So in some cases, you know, and I just, again, look at the data, you know, we have eliminated and suspended in the last 5 years in the universities of Wisconsin, I think about 100 and close to 115 degree programs, right, that we just suspended or that we just closed and say, you know, now, when you say suspended or closed, you know, it's complicated because students need to go through the courses, they need to graduate, right, and then you don't take any new students in. I at the campus sometimes said, I just shelve it. I don't necessarily just eliminate, because if I eliminate it, I have to reapply again to the regions to get it approved. So I just put it on a shelf and say, we don't offer it anymore. 10 years from now, it might be a relevant program again. So I might take it off, right, and just redo it again. So I call it just shelving of programs. So campuses are aggressively, actively, continuously busy to reevaluate and review programs, but also courses as we move on. And actually, recently, the President Rothman also charged us to look at program elimination process, you know, and actually reevaluate. This will be soon available. We will really look with the shared governance groups, with the faculty, with the provost, and say, how do we approach this in the future? Because, you know, part of our future is also a collaborative future, right? We need to do more course sharing. We need to do more. We do already good collaborative degree programs, but part of our future is a collaborative future. So it's not just where you eliminate, it's also where you collaborate. Because there might be a student who wants to take French or Greek, and maybe there's one in this campus, one in that campus. Can we not be creative enough to say, well, we offer it through this version, with a collaborative effort. So it's not just elimination, it's also creative collaboration.
You mentioned the regents, the Board of Regents. What is the relationship between the Universities of Wisconsin and the Board of Regents?
Well, it's a very close relationship, of course, because President Rothman reports to the regent. The regents approve our degree programs. And, you know,
and the tuition, too.
And the tuition, yeah. So it's a good relationship. I think it's one of the most important relationships. You know, even in my office, I always keep specifically with the education committee, one-on-one meetings with the regents to keep that relationship just on a very personal, professional, good level. But there's a lot of decision-making authority within the regents.
What are the challenges for you then in your position in terms of being the senior vice president for academic and student affairs at the Universities of Wisconsin? What are the largest burdens for you?
I think for me, I would rather say it's creative challenges as I look at the future. One is AI. I am very curious to see how this is going to impact us. Is this going to be like the internet that's really changing fundamentally what we do? I think it is. It's not like the MOOCs, the massive open online courses in 2012, where everybody said, oh, this is going to change general education. Everybody going to take those massive for free. Universities didn't embrace that financial model. But I think AI in the academic space specifically is profound. Just think of plagiarism as we define it now, and creative writing as we define it now, and degree programs, and students that might be so savvy that the faculty member might say, oh boy, I miss out, you know, that gap. So that's one of the challenges, I think, in a creative way, is how do we work with the AI space? The other one is just, how do we change perception? How do we continue to change perception? I firmly so believe in what I do, that I sometimes think, why can other people not see this?
That's true of so many of us.
Yeah, you know, so how can we, and I am very sensitive to that. And I work with my own people, with the faculty, and say, how can we help to change a perception that what we do is actually also to the benefit of this? So that, I think the perception is a challenge. That I think that's why we do this marketing and branding, right? And say, we value, we want to be affordable, we want to make sure you have return on investment. We're there for you, we have one of the best professors, right? There is something good in it. And I think the other challenge for me is just, how do we continue to create a culture of change? I predict more changes as we move on with collective wisdom, right? The political space in which we operate, the technology space in which we operate, the financial space. We need creativity. We need to adapt more to change in a collaborative future for us.
How does the UW compete with other institutions for faculty?
Norman, how much time do we have?
I was afraid of that.
Yeah, that's always a challenge. You know, I remember in 2011, I think, when the chancellor at the time at my institution here in Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, said, when we talk about the enrollments is starting to go down, the tuition freeze and state support, he said, we have a perfect storm. I still remember that 14 years later. I said, that is a perfect, and it lasts for 10 years, right? That was really a challenge for us at the University of Wisconsin from a faculty perspective, because we're labor intensive, right? 80% or whatever of our budget is in people. And what you do, you instruct, you have faculty that do research, right? Faculty that teach. So to keep the faculty and to hire faculty in this climate was very challenging. Madison was the exception in a way, right? They had funds to really keep that. To keep it like a top university is fantastic, right? One of the top 10 that we are in the top 6 in research. It is unbelievable. But the other campuses really, really were challenged, A, to hire faculty in a financial climate, and B, to compensate them accordingly. And you know, faculty is not just about money. We're there for, I just call it a calling. We love what we do. But you also are valued in terms of your income, right?
So, and you can see that number right away.
Yeah, exactly. So the challenge is, where do we then fund funding to retain student faculty or to hire them? So that is the challenge, because we are below our peers. We did studies on that to prove the point that in most of cases, and then you have compression. New associate professors gets hired, and a full professor is here for 30 years. Their salaries are close to one another in the
yes,
same department.
We've
and
seen that.
That is part of the challenges that we have to address as we move forward.
What about competing for students? Now, we've touched on that some in terms of Wisconsin students, but how do you attract students? I think even foreign student enrollment is down a little lately.
Norman, I think, you know, when we look at the current students we have, I see two options or two spaces strategically, and it's also reflected in our strategic plan. One is what I just call the other students, people who already have some form of credits, right? And not every one of them have to come back to complete a degree, but they're out there. So we have micro-credentials. We have the competency-based education, the flex degree options. We have online. We target that market to say, come back and complete your degree. So it's not just the traditional students. So it's degree completers. Come in. You don't even have, I mean, competency-based education, you don't have any pedagogy. You just test out based on your competency. It's a fun, and it's much more affordable, and it's on your own time. I just said that is one of the best opportunities we have that sets us actually aside in Wisconsin, having that flex option for those students. But then you have those that doesn't necessarily want a degree, but they want upscaling. I want to know more about AI and management, right? We have that short courses that we can offer through continuing education. We just don't serve 164,000 students. If you add it all up with continuing education, extended campus, we're close to probably 1 million students that we touch in this state with one or other form of education and value that we bring to their careers. So I see that space as the other students as critical. And then I just think, you know, retain our own students, increase the participation rate of our students that we have from high schools, get more out-of-state students. It is the best state to live, ask me. I came here, I never went back, right? I came in from another country. I love this state. And thirdly, I do believe we need to continue to work on international students.
Johannes Brits, it has been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me, Norman. I really enjoyed our discussion.
He's the Senior Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs at the Universities of Wisconsin. And as we end this last broadcast of University of the Air, I'd like to thank Emily Auerbach for 30 years of co-hosting this program. It's been a privilege to work with her and to share these conversations with listeners in Wisconsin and beyond. Our engineer for this broadcast has been Jeff Robbins, and you can listen to our archival shows at WPR.org. I'm Norman Gilliland. This has been University of the Air, coming to you from the News Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.